Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Bob Doty reporting. A white suspect arrested after the massacre at a historic black church in Charleston, South Carolina, has been charged with 9 counts of murder, Charleston police said Friday. 21-year-old Dylan Roof also faces a criminal charge of possessing a firearm illegally. He is scheduled to appear in court at 1800 hours UTC Friday for a bail hearing. Federal authorities are investigating the killings as a possible hate crime. Roof, 21, waived extradition and was flown back to South Carolina Thursday in the custody of the FBI. He was arrested in the neighboring state of North Carolina about allegedly driving 400 kilometers from the historic Emmanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church in Charleston, where 9 worshipers, including an 87-year-old woman, were killed and 3 others were wounded late Wednesday. Charleston is holding a prayer vigil for the victims Friday evening. Military officials in Pakistan say at least 20 militants were killed Friday in airstrikes against suspected insurgent hideouts in a northwestern border region. A brief statement says fighter planes targeted remote areas in the Khyber Tribal Agency near the Afghan border, adding about 18 terrorists also being wounded. The historic Khyber Pass serves as one of only 2 trade and transit routes between Pakistan and Afghanistan. The Pakistani military has recently undertaken a formal offensive to flush Pakistani Taliban and their allies from the region, and officials claim most of the area has been cleared there. Military there says the offensive has so far left up to 2,800 militants and 350 soldiers dead. This is VOA News. The Greek prime minister is promising a solution to the Greek debt crisis that will allow the country to return to growth while staying in the eurozone. Alexis Tsipras' pledge on Friday precedes an emergency summit by eurozone leaders on Monday to seal a deal with Greece over its debt crisis. After presenting a proposal to international creditors in Luxembourg Thursday, Greek finance minister Yanis Varoufakis blamed negotiators on the other side for not sealing a deal.
We are dangerously close to a state of mind that accepts an accident. And I urge my colleagues not to fall prey to this state of mind. We can forge a good agreement. Our government is standing by with ideas and with the determination to cultivate the 2 forms of trust necessary to end this Greek drama.
The president of the Eurogroup left the meeting with different impressions about the viability of Greece's proposal and the leader's willingness to make tough decisions on the country's future. Jaron Dijsselbloem.
He basically was saying we will now implement what we had already agreed in the eurozone, so that was not very impressive. What we need is credible measures which fill in the fiscal gaps, which are still in the talks, and credible measures to bring the economy back on track. Those measures are not popular, they will not be easy to take, and the big question is whether the Greek government is prepared to take them.
German Chancellor Angela Merkel, whose country is Greece's main creditor, told German lawmakers in the parliament Thursday that she was still confident that a deal was possible. An international human rights group has called on the European Union to maintain robust search and rescue operations for migrants seeking asylum as thousands of asylum seekers cross the Mediterranean and Europe struggles to develop a new policy for coping with them. Human Rights Watch released a report calling on European Union leaders to prioritize human rights when they approach the migrant question at a summit next week. Thai Prime Minister Prayut Chan-o-cha is urging the public not to panic after the country confirmed its first case of Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, or MERS. Please don't panic. We are taking care of this. If anyone has any doubt about their symptoms, please contact these hospitals, he told reporters Friday. Heart patient from Oman was confirmed Thursday as the first case of MERS in Thailand. The U.S. State Department says the number of terrorist attacks worldwide increased by 35% in 2014, with an 81% rise in the number of deaths, largely due to more terror activity in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Nigeria. The rise in deaths was attributed to attacks that were exceptionally lethal. I'm Bob Doty in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The situation is very difficult at the moment. Given the security constraints, access for all humanitarian partners is very limited. So that means that it's very difficult for us to reach the areas where people are in need of assistance.
That's Andy Needham of the UN Refugee Agency, who says the crisis in Yemen is causing people to flee to Africa. Details coming up.
Also, police in Nigeria say a 60-year-old man burned a young girl to death after accusing her of being a witch. And more than one ton of illegal ivory was crushed today in New York City's Times Square.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from South Africa, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, an international human rights group has called on the European Union to maintain robust search and rescue operations for migrants seeking asylum. Thousands have crossed the Mediterranean, and Europe is struggling to develop a new policy for coping with them. About 1,800 migrants have died crossing the Mediterranean. Thousands of others have taken the short boat trip from Turkey to Greek islands, hoping to make their way to mainland Europe. Human Rights Watch has released a report calling on EU leaders to make human rights for migrants a priority at a summit next week. The rights group says it has interviewed 150 recently arrived migrants on Italian and Greek islands. It says many are trying to escape human rights abuses in their home countries. Many of the migrants come from Syria, Nigeria, Mali, Somalia, and Eritrea. Human Rights Watch researcher Judith Sunderland says saving lives and increasing safe pathways into Europe should be the EU's priorities. Italy has sought relief from sheltering the migrants. It's asking other EU members for help.
The European Union is also expected to begin next week the first phase of its effort to block human traffickers on the Mediterranean. Officials who declined to be identified say the goal will be to destroy smugglers' boats and ships. The plan would require UN approval, as well as approval from Libyan authorities. In related news, Slovak Prime Minister Robert Fico says Slovakia, Hungary, the Czech Republic and Poland are all opposed to an EU proposal to impose migrant quotas on member countries. He says imposing quotas for resettlement contradicts the EU free movement principle.
While the number of refugees crossing the Mediterranean and arriving in the Greek islands continues to grow, another refugee crisis is also getting worse. The conflict in Yemen is severely affecting refugees there, as well as the local population. As a result, thousands of people are leaving Yemen for Djibouti and Somalia. Andy Needham is a spokesman for the UN Refugee Agency, the UNHCR. From Geneva, he spoke to VOA's Joe DiCapua about the situation in Yemen.
The situation is very difficult at the moment, given the security constraints. Access for all humanitarian partners is very limited. So that means that it's very difficult for us to reach the areas where people are in need of assistance. But also because of the constraints at the ports for import of commercial goods and also humanitarian aid, we have a huge delay now where basically food supplies have run out in Haraz camp and we're unable to get the food deliveries in from the port and then by road to the refugees.
How many refugees are we talking about?
Well, in Haraz camp, there are approximately 20,000, mainly Somali refugees. This camp, in recent weeks, the numbers have slightly fluctuated. As you can imagine, there are security issues. There's been airstrikes and shelling in the area in general. And the people have left and fled, perhaps to be with families, and also people have come in. So the number has fluctuated up and down by a couple of thousand. But at the moment, it's about 20,000 people living there.
Now, it used to be that we would talk to UNHCR to get an update on migrants and refugees fleeing Somalia, etc., to try to get to Yemen. And now we're talking about the reverse situation. How many people are leaving Yemen because of the crisis?
Yeah, that's quite right, Joe. The major outflow continues. And the two main countries where we've seen arrivals are Somalia and Djibouti. So to date, we have about 18,000 people have arrived in Djibouti. Approximately half are Yemenis and the other half are different nationalities who are residing and living in Yemen. And also in Somalia, we have about 15,000 people have arrived, of which about 13,000 are Somalis. So they're basically a mix of returning refugees and other Somalis who are living in Yemen.
So what is the UN Refugee Agency doing in those two countries to try to deal with this?
In Djibouti, reception centres have been established and refugees are being accommodated in a camp called Markazi. Majority of those refugees arriving are coming by boat into the port of Obok. So we're receiving refugees there and then ourselves and other agencies are providing assistance and shelter. And then inside in Somalia, the situation is slightly different because the vast majority are Somali returnees. So the dynamic there is to assist those people to return to their nominated areas of return. And that in itself has some complications because some are from northern Somalia and Puntland and Somaliland, but some originate from south and central Somalia, even in around Mogadishu. So that's onward travel has to be arranged and facilitated.
Now, conditions must be very bad for these refugees to want to return to Somalia, considering some of the conditions there. Were you able to talk to any of them to get an idea of what they face when they return home?
Well, what the refugees are saying when they come to our colleagues in Yemen is that, one, they're in desperate situation, desperate measures. They're asking for really straight-out financial assistance because what we hear from the food colleague is that the price of food has doubled, tripled, and even quadrupled. For example, the price of wheat has gone up fourfold in recent days. The country is dependent on import of food. Over 90% of all food is imported. And as I say, the supply lines have pretty much broken down or have been halted. So you have a lot of people now in severe levels of food insecurity. So basically, the refugees are saying we need assistance here and now just so we can survive and live. They're also asking to be moved from perhaps one area to another because of conflict and military activity that's affecting where they live. And a lot of civilian buildings have been damaged. And indeed, hundreds of civilians have been killed, as you know. And then finally, they're also asking for either resettlement, if possible, to another country. And that's a process that takes a long time. Or also assistance to go back to, in the case of Somalis, to go back to Somalia, or for other nationals to go to different countries such as Djibouti or indeed onwards to Ethiopia in the case of Ethiopians.
Now, you talk about the refugees seeking financial assistance. UNHCR is also seeking financial assistance. It seems that many UN agencies these days are only receiving a fraction of what they're asking for in their emergency appeals.
Indeed, and just this morning, again, it's a sign of the times, we had yet another emergency appeal launch where the revised humanitarian response appeal was launched for Yemen. And indeed, UNHCR and all the partners require a lot of funding just to meet the additional needs. So the figures are quite startling when you look at them. The new appeal is for $1.5 billion, but the colleagues assure us that everything has been absolutely prioritized. They've now focused on life-saving activities, water, health, shelter, medicines. But as you say, yes, sadly, more money and more funding is needed from the international community.
Andy Needham is a spokesman for the UN Refugee Agency, the UNHCR, from Geneva. He spoke to VOA's Joe DiCapua.
Police in Nigeria say a 60-year-old man burned a young girl to death after accusing her of being a witch. Chris Stein, with additional information from Ardo Hazard and in Bauchi, reports on why allegations of witchcraft in Nigeria can be so dangerous.
Police say they've arrested 60-year-old Yakubu Vong for luring an 8-year-old girl to his house in the village of Sabonlai in Nigeria's North Central Plateau State, dousing her with lamp oil and setting her ablaze. Plateau State Police spokesman Emmanuel Abu says police believe he attacked the girl because she refused to admit to him that she was a witch. While much of public religious life centers around Christianity and Islam, traditional beliefs are still prevalent in Nigeria. Ishaya Bajama is a civil rights activist who works in Plateau State. He says spiritual healers often use allegations of witchcraft to explain mental or physical illnesses that communities might not be familiar with, or might not have the money or ability to treat.
A lot of people things that people don't have solution for. They are always ascribed to spiritual problems. But a lot of it has to do with social fitness or social misfit.
These allegations are no laughing matter, Bajama says. Poverty, lack of education, and lack of medical care often combine to stigmatize people accused of being witches, or worse.
Who is there to defend her? The easiest way for a society to be free from that responsibility is to name her in such a way that she can easily be nailed and killed so that everybody is free from it.
Abu says the suspect Vong is in custody in the Plateau state capital, Jos. Chris Stein for VOA News, Dakar.
Thank you, Chris. The Nigerian military denies Chad warplanes destroyed six Boko Haram militant camps within Nigerian borders. Major General Chris Okolade says the Chadian claim is incorrect. He says the bombing run must have occurred in neighboring Niger, not Nigeria. The aerial attacks reportedly were in retaliation for two suicide bombings on Monday on police installations in Chad's capital, N'Djamena. More than 30 people were killed and more than 100 injured. Boko Haram has not claimed responsibility for those bombings. Chad, Niger, Cameroon, and Benin have joined Nigeria in a regional military campaign to combat Boko Haram in northeast Nigeria.
Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta says the government will return licenses of 13 money transfer firms whose operations were banned after an Al-Shabaab attack at the Kenya College. The April attack at Garissa University took the lives of nearly 150 students. The firms were on a list of 85 Kenya firms or groups with suspected links to Al-Shabaab, which has links to Al-Qaeda. Rights groups say the ban had a devastating impact on Kenya's own Somali community of about 1 million people.
Tunisia's foreign minister says 10 staff from the Tunisian consulate in Libya were released today after being abducted by gunmen on June 12th. The French news agency reports that diplomatic staff left Tripoli by plane and arrived safely in Tunis today. The foreign minister denied that any agreement had been made to swap Libyan militant Walid Klib for the Tunisians. Klib is a commander with the Libyan Dawn Group. He had been arrested by Tunisian authorities on terrorism charges. Tunisia deported the Libyan Dawn official to Libya. Minutes past the hour. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Well, more than 1 ton of illegal ivory was crushed today in New York City's Times Square. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service sponsored the event. The goal was to raise awareness about the ongoing plight of elephants, especially in Africa, where as many as 35,000 are poached every year. The African Wildlife Foundation, AWF, supported the event. It says Times Square is one of the most recognizable and iconic intersections of the world. AWF officials say by destroying the ivory there, the United States is giving the elephant crisis the kind of global spotlight it deserves. Jamia Mandima is the program director for AWF and attended the ivory crush today. He spoke with me about the significance of today's ceremony.
The message this crush is meant to send is to say no to ivory trade for now until we are satisfied many years from now. Nobody should trade and sell ivory. So crushing it simply says it has no commercial value.
With the United States becoming more involved in stopping the illegal trade of ivory, such as there are a few bills pending in Congress and some states are getting involved as well. For instance, Massachusetts has a bill now that they're trying to get passed to ban the sale of ivory and rhino horns. How will this help to stop poaching in Africa?
So in this kind of crisis, it always requires a globally respected leader to show by example that they're actually taking action seriously. And as we see all these bills being promulgated and the U.S. government publicly declaring that they are not accepting ivory as a part of a commercial commodity, it sends a very strong message to all other parties. And what it implies is for anybody who is contemplating continuing to poach on the African continent, they have to think twice to say, once they've poached and got the commodity, where does it go? Who buys it? Because it can't enter the market anymore.
Have you noticed a reduction in the poaching with the recent public displays of burnings and crushings of ivory, both in Africa as well as the United States?
I think it would be too early to correlate. What we certainly know is that because of the scaling up of actions along all the different parts of the supply chain, from source through the trafficking edge to the demand, you can certainly tell that there is a lot of caution or maybe reduction on part of some of the main elephant range sites, which in itself indicates that whoever is causing this is rethinking. And above all, it's clear that we have also ramped up the efforts to conduct law enforcement on the ground to really kind of directly attribute any reduced poaching to the crashes. Could be maybe being presumptuous, but what I believe is it's a combination of different variables and different actions that all add up to what becomes reduced poaching.
Also, how can countries partner more in stopping this poaching that is going on?
A couple of ways. One is the fact that we have seen more and more regional dialogues, cross-border discussions, intent to establish what are called wildlife enforcement networks or interagency task forces. And what this means for countries is there's now openness and acceptance that we need to work together. We need to consider dealing with this issue as a serious crime that requires the whole of the world. So no longer follow the political boundaries and try to look inside, but look beyond, because it's transnational organized crime that goes beyond boundaries. So we see a lot of that dialogue. If you think of Africa specifically, a lot of the regional economic communities, you know, SADC, East African Community, COMESA, are trying to incorporate and include the wildlife crime issue under their discussions, which is great. And then across all the way between the West and the South, we see a lot of that exchange as well happening.
African countries have been reporting the decline of the elephant population in their countries due to poaching. Do you think African countries, the governments of their countries, do you think they are doing all they can at this point to stop poaching?
I think what African nations need to do, which they've started to do, is to own and be part of the issue and the actions being taken on. We have seen a series of high-level political meetings held, convened Botswana as the champion. And that has actually resulted in action plans being developed. And more recently, the African Union had again another, you know, symposium in Congo Brazzaville, end of April, where they developed an action plan which is developed by the Africans as the source countries. And that, to me, implies that the African Union has brought on board this as a priority act issue. And hopefully what will follow on is allocation of commensurate resources to also add on to what the rest of the international community is doing.
Jimmy L. Mandima is the program director for the African Wildlife Foundation. He spoke with me from New York City, where illegal ivory was publicly destroyed earlier today.
In South Africa, debate continues over the refusal of the government to arrest Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir last weekend. He was in Johannesburg attending the African Union summit. Mr. Bashir returned home on Monday despite a South African court order barring him from leaving until a decision could be made over whether to arrest him. The International Criminal Court has issued arrest warrants for Mr. Bashir for alleged war crimes and genocide in Darfur, Sudan. Many AU supporters say the continent should have its own version of the ICC. Some say the continent's leaders could strengthen the AU's African Court on Justice, Human and People's Rights. Otilia Ana Mongoniza is senior researcher at the Institute for Security Studies in Pretoria, South Africa. Reporter William Eagle asked her about the change being considered to boost the powers of the court.
Well, the protocol amending the protocol to the African Court on Justice, Human and People's Rights was adopted last year at the June summit in Malabo, Equatorial Guinea. It does require 15 ratifications. As of now, there are no countries that have ratified the amendment protocol. There are just countries that have signed it. but those still fall far short of the required 15. Whether or not countries will begin to ratify now in the coming months is something that we're yet to see. But beyond ratifying, the court actually needs to be operationalized. And there are some concerns there in terms of whether they have the sufficient capacity, which includes human as well as capital, in order to actually put this court into practice. But there are also concerns that have been raised around the fact that this protocol includes an immunity provision, which basically would mean that even if it were to come into being, the African court would not, for example, prosecute al-Bashir of Sudan if he remains president, because it only gives immunity to people for as long as they're in office.
Another consideration, I understand, is having some countries to adopt universal jurisdiction to hear international crimes such as war crimes or genocide. One such case is going on now with AU support, I understand, in Senegal, where Hissine Habré is being tried. Is that another possibility, another alternative? And does that also allow states to try current sitting leaders?
While it's being heralded as, you know, one of the success stories, these are prosecutions for crimes that were committed in the 1980s. So it is a long time coming. Whether that would then translate to possibly prosecuting people who currently hold office, that is unlikely. The move on the African continent now is to continue to protect people for as long as they're in office. There are other efforts in various countries towards prosecuting international crimes, some by way of domesticating the Rome Statute, others by way of establishing special chambers like the one in Senegal. The more recent one is in the Central African Republic. It hasn't started yet, but it has been mooted as a possibility that they would establish a special court to deal with international crimes. In many ways, going back to the al-Bashir issue, it's ironic that in trying to get an arrest warrant here in South Africa, the South African civil society were actually invoking an existing law in South Africa that also enables universal jurisdiction. That law was acknowledged by the judges but ignored by the government in flouting the decision of the court to issue an arrest warrant. So the question isn't so much whether countries will have universal jurisdiction, it's whether the courts will have the freedom to exercise that universal jurisdiction.
That was Otilia Anamongoniza of the Institute for Security Studies in Pretoria, South Africa. She spoke with VOA's William Eagle. This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Music Time in Africa, your connection to the best Pan-African music. Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, inviting you to join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC. Every show brings you the best music from across the continent. Old songs you know and love, and new songs to discover. You'll meet artists, too. Listen to Africa's superstars and rising stars in exclusive, unplugged interviews on the radio or on my YouTube channel. Search for Heather Maxwell, Music Time in Africa. We play only the best right here on VOA Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Human Rights Watch calls on the European Union to maintain robust search and rescue operations for migrants seeking asylum. Police in Nigeria say a young girl has been burned to death after being accused of practicing witchcraft. And more than 1 ton of illegal ivory was crushed today in New York City's Times Square. Coming up, we'll have music from South Africa. And in our feature segment, an entrepreneur in Ghana designs fancy coffins. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehias Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. It's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Happy Friday, Sunny.
Happy Friday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand a big basketball star is being remembered in South Sudan.
Kim, today, Friday, marks the fifth anniversary of the death of South Sudanese basketball star Manute Bol. The African giant, 2.31 meters tall, died June 19, 2010, from acute kidney failure at the age of 47. During his 10-year National Basketball Association career, Manute played for four clubs, including the Golden State Warriors, who won the NBA title earlier this week. To remember him, young South Sudanese players on Friday tipped off the 8-day Manute Bol Peace Builders basketball tournament in the capital, Juba. Achue Chol is the wife of Nicola Bol, brother of the late Manute Bol, and one of the tournament organizers. My VOA colleague James Buddy called her in Juba and asked her why she wanted to stage the competition.
Because Manute Bol was a peacemaker, and the situation in South Sudan, I thought about that this is the time that using Manute's legacy will unite us together.
The children that are participating in the tournament, are they from where? Juba or all over South Sudan?
All over South Sudan. It is actually all the South Sudanese that are taking part on this tournament. All tribes in South Sudan on Friday.
You said to give peace to their war-torn country. It must be frustrating for the young people of South Sudan, given that this conflict is going on. How do young people feel, and why do people like you, what hope do you have by organizing this kind of tournament?
The hope for this is peace. I want the young generation to put down the division and come together. So I believe that basketball can unite us. It can bring the young generation together in the court of basketball.
Now, talk to us a little bit about Manute Bol. I know he played a major role in making sure that the country we know today as South Sudan come about. Unfortunately, he did not see the independence, the referendum, and all that. So can you tell us a little bit about Manute Bol, the person, who he was?
Manute Bol is a man of peace. He loves peace. All his life, he has been committed to his country, working hard for his people. His dreams is to bring better life to his people of South Sudan. Manute Bol would like this young generation to have better life, better education, better country. And basketball was one of his dreams as well. He put all his money towards this country to bring better life for them, better future for better education as well. I thought about it and I thought, let's be a torch for Manute to follow his footsteps and do what he loves. And I'm sure he would have been happy to see today how excited and how happy were the young people meeting in the court of basketball, playing together.
We understand that one of Manute Bol's teams, the Golden State Warriors, which in fact won this year's NBA championship, donated some T-shirts that the children are going to be wearing.
Yes. First of all, let me say congratulations to Golden State Warriors. Golden State Warriors donated 3 boxes of T-shirts, of their own T-shirt, to us. They really did well. We are very happy. We would like that Golden State support South Sudan youth basketball team with more teams for the rest of the future. And also, not only that, the 12 teams that are taking part on the Manute Bowl tournament are very happy to say thank you as well to Golden State Warriors and to congratulate them for winning the champion after 40 years.
That's Achue Chol, one of the organizers of the Manute Bowl Peace Builders Basketball Tournament, and she spoke with my VOA colleague James Buddy from Juba, South Sudan. We heard Achue Chol congratulate the Golden State Warriors for their first NBA title in 40 years. The Warriors scored a 105-97 road victory over the Cleveland Cavaliers earlier this week to win the NBA Finals 4-2. Golden State swingman Andre Iguodala, whose father is Nigerian, was named the most valuable player of the NBA Finals. Hey, Andre, are you surprised to receive the award?
I'm not surprised because I'm that confident in my game. I'm too hard on myself most of the time. I'm not surprised, but I would have bet on Steph. I would have bet on Draymond. Draymond's been great for us all year, and very, very high IQ guy. And this is the type of series where he can get triple-double numbers every night. And we saw it in the Houston series, and I knew it would carry over. So those two guys I would have bet on, and I was just happy we were winning the ring. Like, I didn't really care about anything else. This is just a plus.
That's Andre Iguodala of the Golden State Warriors, the most valuable player of the NBA Finals. Golden State's head coach is Steve Kerr, who won 5 NBA titles as a player and now his first as a coach. If you're keeping score, VOA basketball fans, that gives Kerr 6 championship rings, the same number won by his former Chicago Bulls teammate Michael Jordan. Coach Kerr, who's your pick for NBA Finals Most Valuable Player?
You could make an argument that it could have gone to Steph, it could have gone to LeBron, but for us, it's really fitting that the award went to Andre because he sacrificed his starting role from the first game of the season. He had never come off the bench once in his entire career, and he sacrificed that job to make Harrison better, to make our bench better, and that set the tone for our whole season. An all-star, an Olympian, saying, okay, I'll come off the bench. It set the tone for everything we were able to accomplish, so it feels like full circle to me that Andre received the award. Couldn't happen to a better person.
Thanks, Coach. That's Steve Kerr, the head coach of the Golden State Warriors, the 2015 National Basketball Association champion.
They're playing back.
I'm Shegun Adeyemi, coming to you all the way from Lagos, Nigeria. Weekends are for sports. Nightline Africa Sports, that is. And every Sunday, I'll give you highlights of the top sports stories of the past week and the weekend. Nightline Africa Sports from the Voice of America. Let the games begin.
We got the game.
This is Larry Zamuje, Chairman, Chief Executive, Sports Radio 80.9, Brilla FM, Lagos and Abuja, Nigeria. Let's talk to you about Brilla FM. It's Nigeria's only sports station. Of course, we partner at UA.
VOA.
And so you can listen to Sunny Side of Sports on 80.9, Brilla FM, Lagos and Abuja. Keep listening, Africa, and enjoy Sunny Side of Sports on Brilla.
Thanks, Dr. Larry. In addition to Sports Radio 88.9 Brilla FM stations in Lagos and Abuja, Dr. Larry also has stations in Kaduna and Onitsha, Nigeria. We're delighted to be your partner, Dr. Larry, so keep it sporty.
The Voice of America, VOA.
Joining us now with more sports news is the VOA's Daybreak Africa sportsman, Mark Ouma. And Mark's opening serve is African women's volleyball.
Tunisia beat Morocco 25-16, 25-21, 21-25 and 25-21 in the fifth place playoff at the Women's African Nations Volleyball Championships in Nairobi, Kenya on Thursday. Earlier on, Mauritius outplayed Botswana 17-25, 25-21, 25-19 and 25-21 in the seventh place playoff. Tomorrow Saturday, Senegal play Cameroon in the bronze medal playoff before Algeria challenge defending champions Kenya in the final. Turning to football, Mali plays Senegal in the bronze medal playoff at the men's FIFA Under-20 World Cup in Auckland, New Zealand, tomorrow Saturday. Later, Brazil plays Serbia in the final. Elsewhere, Cameroon encounter China in the second round at the FIFA Women's World Cup in Edmonton, Canada. In Namibia, the Council of Southern Africa Football Association's COSAFA Cup champions Namibia host Zambia in the opening leg of their Orange Africa Nations Championship qualifier in Windhoek tomorrow Saturday. Playing in front of their fans for the first time after winning the COSAFA Cup in South Africa, coach Ricardo Manetti reckons Namibia's brave warriors have what it takes to carry the day.
To keep the momentum going from COSAFA with this qualifiers, to keep the same momentum going. We're going to face our familiar opponents, which is Zambia. We met them at COSAFA. They are going to lose a few players because they didn't play their Chan team. We also didn't play our Chan team. So it was a mixture of professional players and local players. So that will be a very interesting game. The good thing and the positive thing for me is the fact that we will play them first in Windhoek. And we're very positive that we will get a good result there. And then we take care of the away match.
That was Ricardo Manetti, the Namibia Brave Warriors coach, speaking in Windhoek, Namibia. Elsewhere, in other Orange Africa Nations Championship qualifiers, Senegal play Gambia, South Africa engage Mauritius, Guinea-Bissau challenge Mali, Mauritania face Sierra Leone, and Djibouti play Burundi. Tanzania face Uganda, Mozambique play Seychelles, as Zimbabwe hosts Comoro Islands. On Sunday, Ethiopia welcome Kenya, Lesotho host Botswana, Swaziland engage Angola, and Morocco play Libya. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa, wishing you all a sporty weekend.
Thanks, Mark, and we're wishing you a sporty weekend, too. Follow the Sunny Side of Sports on Facebook and Twitter. My Facebook address is facebook.com/VOASunny, and my Twitter handle is @VOASunnySports. If you go to my Facebook page, you'll see a wonderful photo of Cameroonian striker Jeanette Yango celebrating with fans at Commonwealth Stadium in Edmonton. As Mark Ouma mentioned, Jeanette and the indomitable Lionesses of Cameroon will be back on the pitch in Edmonton Saturday when they play the Steel Roses of China in the round of 16 at the Women's World Cup. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Have a good weekend, everyone. Back to Yahias Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny, and listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, the entrepreneur in Ghana designing fantasy coffins uniquely created to capture the essence of the departed. And next, a shopping mall constructed entirely out of shipping containers. But first, some music. Here is Yovan Chaka Chaka from South Africa with Motherland. South Africa's Yvonne Chaka Chaka with Motherland.
Well, have you ever seen a coffin made to resemble an animal? How about a film projector or a Bible? An entrepreneur in Ghana is designing fantasy coffins uniquely created to capture the essence of the departed, whether a character trait, an occupation, or a symbol of one's standing in the community. Paul Indiho recently visited Kane Kwe Carpentry Workshop in Tesek, Accra.
Ghanaians are well known for their elaborate coffins, from stools to symbolize a chief to big pens for teachers, journalists, and lawyers.
This family enterprise has been passed on from generation to generation. A lot of people come here for customized coffins.
We have the film projector, also for an old film producer or something. We crab, which is a totem of a particular clan. We have the lobster, which is also supposed to be for a chief fisherman. We have the old trotro for a driver.
Like father, like son, Eric Ajeti Anang has been running this family business, which was started by his grandfather more than 50 years ago. The business has been passed down from generation to generation.
I'm the grandson of Kane Kwe. Kane Kwe happens to be the initiator and the initiator of design coffins in Ghana.
The tradition of adding designs or sculpturing coffins dates back to the Egyptian times. In Ghana, for instance, hand-carved coffins are popular and can be seen as a status symbol or a way of remembering the deceased's job or personality. Eric Anang's imagination runs wild in his carpentry shop. He's made everything from a tilapia casket for a fisherman to this cocoa pod for a farmer.
So the family comes with the idea of the profession of the deceased. So let's assume the deceased is a driver. They come with the idea of the car the deceased was driving. So if it's something I've done before, I could suggest let's try to do a modern car or something. So we don't do any drawings at all, but we try to get a prototype of what we are doing.
These fantasy coffins continue as a tradition in Ghana today and have been commissioned by people from around the world and are also a display at various museums around the world.
I sent 24 pieces to Denmark, and just this morning I got to understand a museum bought all the 24 pieces. I was there also myself. I built 2 pieces, which has also been sold. I sent 20 pieces last year to Russia, and they ended up in a museum. A couple of months ago, like in January or February, I sent one to Florida, which is in the form of a seahorse.
Eric says the technology of building the most popular coffins is perfectly controlled.
If you want to send away your loved one in a customized coffin, this is the place where you come to get that made for you.
Thank you, Paul. And that's Paul Indiho at a coffin-making carpentry shop in Accra, Ghana.
A shopping mall constructed entirely out of shipping containers is nearly completing in Johannesburg. The architectural design is called 27 Boxes because each container is 27 square meters. It is a first for Africa and is modeled on similar projects in London, Paris, and Christchurch. Darren Taylor has the story.
Construction workers add finishing touches to the 27 Boxes project in the creative Johannesburg suburb of Melville. Its creator is Satik Group structural engineer and architect Arthur Blake.
We had extremely limited funds. It continued to rain. As we went down, we got rock, which delayed the project. We've never done a retail development. This one took me by surprise at how long it would actually take.
Blake says he didn't want to build just another shopping mall, of which the city has plenty.
They've got no character. They're just brick buildings.
He wanted to do something different at the site, something he'd never before attempted, to construct an affordable shopping space entirely from shipping containers. The recycled material is significantly cheaper to build with than conventional steel, brick, and mortar. This project cost about $2.5 million, as opposed to $3.5 million for a traditional build. But from the outset, says Blake, there were plenty of skeptics.
People just said containers are checks on steroids.
One of the doubters was Blake's colleague, project marketing manager Mandy Shave.
I thought shipping containers, running a mall within shipping containers, how's it going to work? How are they going to fit?
But Blake's vision of completing the development for Melville's dreamers and artists, as he calls his soon-to-be tenants, wouldn't die.
This unique opportunity just started developing in my mind that we could create a space for these guys. Simultaneously, we could develop the park into a very artisanal zone.
Shave says about 100 containers will be rented to people selling products you won't easily find at a mall packed with franchise stores. From craft beer to Philly cheesesteaks and wood-fired bread to handmade jewelry and clothing.
And we've done a very good job to make sure that we have a very good mix of people, that it's people who've got, you know, high-end, beautiful quality products, a strong focus on making sure it is artists, and then giving them an opportunity to open a store.
On average, the containers will cost about $400 a month to rent, much cheaper than stores in the big malls, which can easily cost 10 times more. This has made it possible for people like Sean Mulroe to be one of 27 Box's first tenants.
I'm going to be opening a nursery. I'm going to be mostly selling veggies and herbs, and hopefully selling fresh herbs and veggies to the little restaurants that are opening as well, so we can all keep organic and fresh.
Shave says 27 Boxes, with its many open spaces, will be one of the most environmentally friendly shopping areas ever in South Africa.
The green aspect of using a shipping container is also what is attracting a lot of people to go, wow, this is so different. I didn't realize you could do this with a shipping container.
Blake says several internationally renowned architects have congratulated him on what he describes as his dream project. And 27 Boxes is set to open within a few weeks. Darren Taylor for VOA News, Johannesburg.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our African News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Peter Hundley, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Zimbabwe, once a pride of Africa and its breadbasket, has fallen far in recent decades, driven down by government policies, political violence, and economic decline. The nation's leaders, after many years of confrontation, now seek to re-engage with the West, hoping to see an easing of targeted sanctions they blame for many of the country's problems. Some restrictions, in fact, have been removed by the European Union against some officials, and the possibility of financial aid has been discussed. The United States, however, believes that current circumstances in the troubled Southern African nation do not merit a change in our policies there, though we remain hopeful that in the future they will. Last month, two top U.S. diplomats, Deputy Assistant Secretaries of State Shannon Smith and Stephen Feldstein, spent 4 days in Zimbabwe assessing conditions there with government leaders, U.S. Embassy staff, opposition lawmakers, and civil society. In the meetings, they reaffirmed U.S. messages of support for the Zimbabwean people and communicated our nation's hopes for economic development and democratic reforms. They also pressed the case of human rights activist Itai Dzamara, who went missing on March 9th after having been forced into a car by five men. He hasn't been seen since. What they found was a fractured political system, an economy in desperate straits, and looming food insecurity caused by drought and harmful government agricultural policies. Against this backdrop, they reported at the time, and Mr. Smith repeated in a hearing before our Congress on June 2nd, that U.S. interests in Zimbabwe remain the same. Travel and financial sanctions imposed on government leaders and their supporters linked to political violence and human rights abuses will remain in place, while we continue to support and promote a peaceful, democratic, and prosperous Zimbabwe that provides for its people and contributes to regional stability. To realize these interests, we will remain engaged with both government and non-government leaders alike to work together in areas of common concern. In so doing, the United States remains the leading provider of humanitarian assistance to Zimbabwe in the form of food aid, HIV/AIDS prevention programs, democracy, humanitarian assistance, economic growth, agriculture, and health infrastructure support. Our assistance has saved countless lives, is strengthening civil society, and is laying the groundwork for a brighter future for the Zimbabwean people.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Next on Let's Talk, join host Sunday Shamari and his guests discussing accents. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest with some hilarity. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 1730 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.